Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Catherine French. I'm the Senior Appellate Coordinator with the Virginia Indigent Defense Commission, and along with Joan Furrow from the Richmond Public Defender's Office, we represent Vernon Augustin. There's two very important issues that this Honorable Court is called upon to address today. The first issue is the preservation reference requirement to Rule 5A12 the assignment of error, or is it a separate but related component? The second important issue for this court to address is if a preservation reference is not sufficiently exact, does that mandate dismissal or deprive the court of active jurisdiction? Augustin's position is that preservation reference is different than the assignment of error, that the preservation reference is not an inherent component of the assignment of error. Augustin also maintains that even if there is an error with the preservation reference, even if it violates Rule 5A12, that it does not mandate dismissal, and because it does not, that rule violation would be a non-jurisdictional rule violation. So for the reasons why the preservation...
Let me stop you. Maybe I'm looking at it wrong, but I think the Court of Appeals denied this petition. Did not dismiss it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
And our position is that the court was wrong in denying it on procedural grounds, that the court should have resolved it on the merits. However, alternatively, I think that where the common ground is between the Commonwealth and Mr. Augustin is assuming, but we're not conceding, that Augustin's preservation references were not sufficiently exact. And only if this Honorable Court finds that the assignment of error is the preservation reference, and that's essentially what the Court of Appeals found, then the proper disposition would be dismissal of the appeal instead of denial of the appeal, which the Court of Appeals did. However, the reason why this would not be, why the court should have considered this and addressed this on the merits, is that this really was, as recent case law in the Court of Appeals, Brooks, Chapman point out, is that any violation was a minor violation. And because a preservation reference violation is not the same as a violation with the assignment of error, that the court should have addressed it on the merits.
Let me stop you a second. So the way I read the Court of Appeals per curiam order here is that they considered this, and this is based also on their prior cases, that the preservation portion is not part of the assignment of error, that the error, that the failure to have a more specific reference here was significant, and they denied the petition. I thought I heard you say that they thought it dismissed it or denied it because it was part of the assignment of error.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. If we go to, just a moment, and I'll pull up the order. It says, the assignments of error fail to comply with Rule 5A12C. Thus, we will not consider the merits of this case. For the reasons stated below, we find that these defects...
5A12C includes the preservation portion, doesn't it?
Yes. But by saying that Augustin's assignments of error failed to comply with that rule, the court, in its reasoning, explains that the reason that they're saying the assignments of error do not comply with the rule is because the Court of Appeals reasoned that the preservation references are an inherent part of the assignment of error, that it is the assignment of error. Otherwise, the per curiam would have said, although the assignments of error comply, the preservation references violated Rule 5A12C. But the way that I read that first paragraph, well, really the second paragraph, but the first paragraph of substance, is that the Court of Appeals, in contrast to the recent case law, in this particular case, the per curiam opinion was conceptualizing the preservation reference as a necessary component of the assignment of error. And we assigned error to that finding.
But it's your position that it is not, the preservation portion is not part of the assignment of error.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Which means that the case cannot be dismissed.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I do believe that the case can still be dismissed. Even with Eggleston's position, dismissal, our contention is dismissal is not the only, is not just a remedy when there is a jurisdictional violation. That the dismissal can also be a remedy when there is a non-jurisdictional rule dismissal as well. And this honorable court in Moore versus Commonwealth, that case does suggest that the court can dismiss based on a non-jurisdictional rule violation. And that court, in that opinion, the court said invocation of a non-jurisdictional rule to dismiss an appeal or to prevent consideration of its merits should not be undertaken without considering whether a party's failure to adhere strictly to the rule's requirements is insignificant or so substantial as to preclude the court's addressing the merits of the case. So if this court agrees with Eggleston that, assuming but without conceding that his preservation references were inexact and violated Rule 5A12, if the court agrees that that would be a non-jurisdictional rule violation, dismissal can be an appropriate remedy. With a non-jurisdictional...
Counsel, did we say in J that if it is non-jurisdictional and significant, it will be denied? Is that the holding of J?
For J, I read very narrowly that J talked about a completely different rule, Rule 5A20E, and the way I read J is that the court has many options when there is a non-jurisdictional rule violation. J does indicate that waiver could be an option, but emphasizes that if there is an insignificant defect, such as this would be an insignificant defect, as Brooks and Chapman says that it's a relatively minor mistake, that then the court should consider it on its merits.
But if the court decides that it is not an insignificant defect, then doesn't J require that it be denied?
No, I do not believe that J requires it to be denied. I think that Moore, which came after J, and cited J, is clear that the court can dismiss based on a non-jurisdictional violation. And that's what the Court of Appeals en banc did with Brooks. Brooks was a case where counsel had multiple opportunities to fix the error. Do want to point out in this case that the court never brought to the attention of counsel before that first hearing that there may be an error. There was no show cause issue, there was no order, there was no direction to fix it. And in Brooks, the court finding that it was insignificant. I look at it not so much as, I think first, is it a jurisdictional or is it a non-jurisdictional rule violation? If it's a jurisdictional rule violation, then the court has to dismiss. But if it's a non-jurisdictional violation, the court has dismissal as an option, but there is a range of other options too. And in here, in contrast with Brooks, if the Court of Appeals en banc dismissed it, here a procedural denial is an even harsher penalty because Eggleston cannot then...
I understand that. Mm-hmm. Do the cases then, once you dissect jurisdictional versus non-jurisdictional, mm-hmm. then do you look to whether it's significant or insignificant to decide dismissal versus denial?
My position would be that when it is insignificant, and I think Jay supports this as well as Moore and even Smith, is that if it's insignificant, that the court should consider it on the merits. Because I believe.
And what if it is significant?
If it's insignificant,
no. What
significant?
If,
I'm
yes.
Sorry.
What if
it's significant? I believe that under the current law, the court has a range of options.
You rely on Moore for that?
I would rely on Moore for that. I think Jay does support that. I would also argue alternatively for Jay that, again, that case can be distinguishable from this case in that we are talking about different rules. But I do believe with a significant rule violation based on the current law that the court has options. But here in this particular case, it would be an abuse of discretion not to consider it on the merits. And it would also be an abuse of discretion to deny it, because denial is, quite frankly, the harshest penalty that a criminal appellant can experience. And looking to the language of the rules, too, the text of the rules and the goals of what the recent advisory committee was looking to do was to create a uniformity and a harmony between the rules of the Court of Appeals and the rules of the Supreme Court. And looking at the goals of that, and part of the goal was not to punish appellants for counsel's mistake, especially if there is a relatively minor mistake. And so that's why I do think that if there is a violation, that this would be an insignificant violation. And even if this court found that it was significant of why a procedural denial is an abuse of discretion, because it, the interpretation that Eggleston advances is in harmony with the plain language of the rules as well as the goals of the advisory committee. The language of the rules note that a preservation reference is with the assignment of errors, to be included with. And that signifies that they are different and distinct components. And that separation of the components is why Davis does not control, of why this is not mandatory dismissal, that this would be an insignificant non-jurisdictional rule violation.
Counsel, well, how is it insignificant if you have five volumes and the reference is to, or you have five volumes of a transcript from a hearing and the reference is to volume one? How can that be insignificant when you're asking the court to go through the entire volume to determine where your assignment of error lies?
Okay. A couple of responses, Your Honor. First, based on Brooks and Chapman and Witt, the Court of Appeals has deemed that, where in Brooks, that it was an that the relatively minor error is the same language to me as it's insignificant. And especially in this case, it's not as if there was no preservation reference. There was a preservation reference, and there were seven volumes, and the footnote referred it to the one volume. And essentially, because of that X, it's a minor oversight of counsel that counsel, quite frankly, didn't go in and elaborate on where that would be. And that's a simple mistake that could be easily correctable. It's not saying that attorneys shouldn't follow the rules or get a free pass, but the client shouldn't be suffer. There can be a show cause to the attorney. There can be an order. There could be, you know, a bar disciplinary. There could be an admonishment. There's a lot of, it's, even if it's insignificant, doesn't mean that the court wouldn't be able to address it and just has to ignore it.
Does whether it's insignificant or not turn in any way on how big the transcript is? I mean, we've all seen transcripts that are maybe 50 pages, and we've seen transcripts that are 200 pages.
I think that given that there's seven different volumes, that it is, that the reference was to the correct transcript. But even if
we don't even know how big that transcript is, I mean, without going to the record and...
Right. But even if the court found that it was a violation of the rule, even if there was no preservation reference, which was not the case here, I still think that would be insignificant. If it would be okay with the court, I'd like to reserve my remaining minute or so for a rebuttal.
Right.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Alice Armstrong on behalf of the Commonwealth. There are a couple of, I guess, discrete or preliminary issues to address, one of which is what is and what isn't the assignment of error, and then whether this satisfied either, whether it isn't a part of the assignment of error or not, whether this is an exact reference or anything closely resembling an exact reference. Your Honors, I would submit that the preservation error is part of the assignment of error. It's not the assignment of error, as I think counsel was trying to frame the issue. It's not the assignment of error, but it is a necessary part of the assignment error. The rule says that the preservation reference shall be included with the assignment of error. So an assignment of error that does not include the preservation reference is incomplete under the rules and therefore insufficient. In this case, There is not an exact reference. There's not anything even closely approaching an exact reference. The best we get is if we delve to the footnote, is it's somewhere in this transcript, and I may tell you later where. But that's not an exact reference. It's actually less exact than what the Court of Appeals condemned in Brooks, where the person actually did give some page numbers. It was a wide range of pages, but at least we were in the ballpark. Here, we have a transcript that we can pull out of the pile of transcripts, and that's where the aid to the court finishes. But the jurisprudence of this court, the jurisprudence of the Court of Appeals, is that it's not the obligation of the court.
Well, it's clearly not, and it's not proper. But, you know, we get those things all the time, and we issue a show cause, and it gets fixed, and everybody moves right along. And until this case, that's what the Court of Appeals did.
Well, until Davis, I think that's probably what the Court of Appeals did. And the Court
so
of Appeals...
Is by getting in between the lines that they're unhappy with Davis?
No, I don't think that they're unhappy with Davis. I don't think anybody is unhappy with Davis. I mean, from the institutional perspective, we thought that Davis was guidance for how we were supposed to move forward. And the court said in Davis, in fairly clear language, I thought, that the amendment of the rules that provided for the dismissal meant that the rules were a break from the Jay and Moore line of cases, and that because that dismissal language was in there, it is now plain that that is a jurisdictional requirement, and failure to follow the jurisdictional requirement deprives the court of jurisdiction, and then that's the end of the inquiry. So I think that as institutional players, those of us sort of working within it, the Court of Appeals and my office, and I think probably others as well, took that to mean that this is the bright line rule. This is a bright line. If it doesn't, does it, you know, we simply open up the petitions to the assignment of error page.
Let me just suggest to you that it could hardly be the bright line rule when we don't follow it. Go ahead.
Well, and I think some of the jurisprudence, some of the more recent jurisprudence makes it's difficult. I think some of these cases are difficult to reconcile.
So somebody is upset with Davis.
Well, I don't know that anybody's upset with Davis. Some people may be upset with some of the other cases.
the efforts that we have made with regard to our rules have been to make them more user-friendly and to not penalize the parties when there's an easy fix. And in this case, there is an easy fix. That's how we do it, and that's how the Court of Appeals have been doing it until this case. And so it's entirely contrary to the entire movement, as if you will, of our rules to be more user-friendly. And that's why it's a bit of an outlier.
Well,
I'm not faulting you about
no,
it.
I mean, no, I'm not taking it that way, and I really... I hope that we actually can have a policy discussion about these rules, because I think that counsel actually has touched on that a little bit, and that is, at least in the criminal context, where there is another remedy available to the defendant, it is not always the more fair or more user-friendly approach to deem something waived or to simply deny a merits review, because then his only remedy... And I know the court will appreciate this from your other background. The only remedy then is to come back and show this court in a collateral proceeding that he suffered from Strickland prejudice. On the other hand, if there is a more strict construction of the rule, if you will, and the courts dismiss them, then he has a very simple remedy through the statute to come back and have his, if you will, proverbial do-over on the merits with a proper assignment of error, and then the court can reach the merits without deeming something waived. So, I understand the court's point, but I hope the court understands my point too, which is, on the surface, it may seem more fair, if you will, or more user-friendly to have something that's a little bit more malleable. The problem is that in an individual case, it may not work out that way. The other problem I would suggest to the court as a policy matter is that when the rule is a little bit more malleable, When we are on collateral review across the street in federal court, then we run the risk that this court's procedural rules are no longer adequate as a matter of federal law. And so I just would caution the court as a policy matter from that perspective as well. And I understand that we don't want to penalize people for minor mistakes, but I think
they become inadequate when they are inconsistent. And what I'm suggesting to you is that the way the Court of Appeals is handling this case is inconsistent with how we handled the same thing. That's when problems come about in the habeas context.
And I do take the court's point, but I also would note, as I noted on the brief, the language of 5A12C actually is a little bit different than the language of 5:17C precisely in this respect. Precisely in the respect of this court's rule does not have that otherwise fails to comply. So this court's rule is more narrowly focused on the laying one's finger on the error aspect of it. This court's rule doesn't have that follow-on language. The Court of Appeals rule does, and I cannot account for the difference in those. I thought that the effort was to have them all be the same.
And doesn't the Court of Appeals rule not contain the show cause provisions that our rule has in it? It's not 5:17 or 5A12, but it's another one of our rules where I think it's 5. I don't think I have it in front of me. 5:1A of our rules talk about the show cause, I think, and there's no comparable provision in the Court of Appeals rules.
Right. Well, I haven't specifically focused on that.
But if I hear you correctly, what you're saying is that from a policy standpoint, as a practitioner trying to utilize these rules and work with cases through the system, from a policy standpoint, it's better if we have a narrow rule that's enforced strictly and narrowly all the time that ends up in dismissals. For perhaps more reasons than we currently dismiss cases for.
Maybe not for more reasons. Maybe the rule can be rolled back. Maybe we can take the language out of 5A12C that says otherwise fails to comply. Maybe we can modify those rules to say to make explicit that the preservation error isn't
Is or is not part of the assignment.
Is or is not part of the assignment of error. But the other problem is, and I think this is an outlier, but only insofar as somehow this slipped through review, as you will, if you will, while Brooks was on en banc review. So I'm really not sure exactly how this particular case sort of came through the system, because Brooks clearly was on en banc review, so the entire court was aware of it. Brooks does say, and I concede that Brooks says that it's not a part of the assignment of error.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Appellant's argument fits within and is consistent with Brooks and Chapman. Would you agree with that or not?
It's consistent with...
Which, of course, were decided after.
Correct.
This case was decided.
And so I don't know why this wasn't on hold, if you will, until they sorted out that question. So,
But if you followed Brooks and Chapman, this case would have been concluded differently. That's your point.
I think it would have been. Right. But I think the interesting policy point is, even though we disagree on a lot of the other points, the underlying issue is when something doesn't satisfy the rules, I think that the institutional litigants here agree that dismissal is the appropriate disposition, because there are, as I said, a whole bunch of other institutional considerations that are maybe going on. But I think the other point is when the rules are more malleable, and the other problem with not having a bright line rule, and I do mean no disrespect to this court or to the Court of Appeals, is that not everything strikes all of us the same way when we're talking about what's significant or insignificant or what's close enough. And then we start having due process implications, because some litigants who are apparently similarly situated may not be treated the same. And I do want to just circle back, Justice Lemons, on the adequacy part. There's two aspects to that, and the other is that an individual litigant can say that the rule was applied exorbitantly in his case. So if he's somebody who was before a panel that was perhaps a bit more strict in its reading of the rules than another litigant who wasn't. I mean, there's an argument to be made, and the case is Hedrick versus True. If the rule is exorbitantly applied in that particular case, then that litigant can forego, or the federal, he can make the case that the federal court can forego the procedural defaults that this court or the Court of Appeals or both imposed in any particular case.
Tell me, Ms. Armstrong, in this case,
yes, ma'am.
How can the court reach a correct result without creating havoc in the law?
I mean, this is the problem with, there are inconsistencies here. And I think it goes back to Davis, and again, it's not a criticism of Davis. I think that when Davis came out, the Court of Appeals understood that to be the sort of, this is the way forward, is that this is how we are meant to apply this rule, and so that's what they were doing, at least in the first instance. But I'm not sure that we can reconcile all the recent cases that we've had. I mean, you cannot reconcile with Davis. I don't think it can be reconciled because Davis said it deprives the court of active jurisdiction. Now, if the court has no active jurisdiction, it cannot. There is no basis on which it can permit an amendment. So I would just encourage
an amendment through a show cause order.
Any kind of amendment.
Right.
There was no show cause in Witt or Chapman. What actually happened in Chapman was that the Commonwealth attorney at the brief and op stage was right on the ball and filed a motion to dismiss. It was in Witt, which the Court of Appeals actually never disposed of. And then they ultimately granted him leave to amend. But the larger point is, something, I think this court has to overrule something, because these things cannot be reconciled. And my position is that Davis was very clear and there was nothing wrongly decided in Davis. So that would be my encouragement to the court. But even if you...
Well, Davis is clear, but the problem comes into, at least from my viewpoint, is what falls within those categories of requirements that are jurisdictional and which ones are not jurisdictional. That's where the confusion perhaps lies.
Well, and I thought that that Davis was actually clarifying, as it were, Moore and Jay in light of the rule change, and that
But Jay did deal with a different rule. It didn't deal with an assignment of error, as I recall.
Did not address the assignment of error, but part of the analysis was that because there was no provision in the rule for dismissal, because the Court of Appeals had dismissed in that case for failure to abide by the rule, that was elevating that rule to a jurisdictional requirement. And so in that, it's in that light that I say that it was illuminating Jay, or saying that now that we have this provision that mandates dismissal,
wouldn't a better way of dealing with this simply to say that identifying the place in the transcript is not a jurisdictional issue, and just move on? I mean, the problem is that the lawyer, not this lawyer, by the way, but the lawyer who tried this case, basically said, in response to that rule, if you want to know where it was preserved, you go look.
Right.
And that understandably irritated the Court of Appeals. It would irritate us too. But the way we handle it is we say, here's a show cause, either put your finger on the error or we are going to dismiss your case. Why wouldn't the manner in which we decide this case be that portion of that rule that requires the finger to be placed on the error in this record is not jurisdictional, but it can be with a show cause order if you don't comply.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, may I respond?
Yes.
I think the court can certainly do that. I think that the institutional concern is that essentially we have to take a Sharpie marker to the second part of 5A12C about the otherwise fails to comply. And I leave that to the field offices of this court, but that is my position.
Well, I understand your argument, and that's what you're here for. So I understand.
Exactly. And I also appreciate your candor about the policy issues.
Thank you, Honors.
Bo.
Thank you. In terms of the difference in language between Rule 5A12 and 517, since I only have a minute, I did address that in my reply brief of how the two can be reconciled, and Eggleston's interpretation is actually consistent with the goals of the advisory committee and the rule. So I did address that in my reply brief. In terms of policy, I think it's very important to keep in mind a couple of policy considerations. One is fairness to the defendants. And certainly a procedural denial is not fair to the defendant, where a dismissal, my client would rather prefer a dismissal where he can have an opportunity for a delayed appeal than a procedural denial. However, what would be not only fair to the client as well, but also efficient for the justice system as a whole, is to do the show cause and not to dismiss it. Because dismissing it, while it is an available remedy, I do believe, and the client can pursue a delayed appeal, it adds back to applying, going through the motion, going through the whole process, where a simple show cause can give accountability to counsel, but protect the client and be fair and efficient to the criminal justice system.